Welcome. This is Syracuse Speaks, the new public affairs program from WAER that tackles the issues that matter to you about Central New York. Today we're going to talk about housing stability in Syracuse. What do city residents face trying to have a safe, secure home, and how does the city plan to address the issue? Thanks for tuning in. I'm Chris Bolt, News and Public Affairs Director here at WAER.
And I'm Katie Zolkowski, WAER announcer and reporter. About a quarter of Syracuse residents move at least once a year, and in some parts of the city, the number can be as high as 35%. That's more than twice the national average. And all of this moving can lead to health problems for tenants, and it erodes a sense of community.
In order to combat these problems, Syracuse has come up with 11 initiatives launched this spring aimed at improving housing stability. To talk about the issues in the Syracuse housing market and plans being made to help, we have Sharon Sherman, Executive Director of the Greater Syracuse Tenants Network. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
Samantha Lynette, Innovation Design Lead with the Syracuse I-Team in City Hall. Thanks, Samantha.
Thank you for having me.
And Palmer Harvey, who's with the TNT Southside Housing Task Force and is a community researcher doing work with SU's Maxwell School on eviction.
Hello.
Hi, Palmer. Thank you. So to get started, I wanted to talk about some of the problems that residents face in Syracuse in just trying to have a house that they can go to, raise their family without having to worry about its stability being there next month or next year or so on. Now, there are so many factors that go into a good place to live. But Sharon, let me start with you, having been in the housing world for a long time here in Syracuse. What are some of the factors that make it just hard for people to know they have a safe place to go that's safe for their family, et cetera?
Well, the one thing is that people don't have enough funds to afford housing. So we have a lack of affordable housing, and we've lost a tremendous amount of subsidized housing in the past 15 years. In addition, the housing is built before 1938, a great amount of it. And in many certain areas of the city, it's in very, very poor repair. People are often desperate to find some place, so they move from one place to another without taking proper time to research and find the best house that they possibly can.
And Palmer, I know you've done some research on people getting kicked out of their home, evictions. What kind of problems do people face? It's a little more complex issue than simply people don't pay their rent and get evicted like the classic way you get evicted, as we think.
Yes, almost definitely. But the people who I've actually interviewed thus far, it's more been like a retaliatory thing. Like, oh, I call Colton, this person, and he's bugging me about this, or he won't fix that, or he'll come, but he'll not do this. And it's a constant cycle. I mean, I've interviewed like five people in a row, and it's like the same issue. It's like, well, if you don't like it, leave. And that's the one thing I hate that landlords say, because as you look at the code violations on Datacuse, it's like literally everywhere in Syracuse has a code violation. It's like nothing's touched. And I think there's like a disconnect with some landlords. I mean, we have some really pretty good ones, but they're far and few between, is what I'm finding out doing the research. And it's just a shame that a lot of these people are going through it, because I was just in court this morning. And just to listen to the people, I mean, they're more inclined to run at you and tell them their stories, like, honestly, and I'm trying to explain to them what the research study is about, and it's like, no, this person's doing this to me, he's, like, not doing this, or he's saying I didn't pay this, or it's so much more complication than what people think it really is, you know? It's one thing to say, Melina brings you in and say, oh, well, you didn't pay this month or pay that month. And you see people with documents saying it could be like as little as $5. And the person brings it in the court just because it's just an irritant to the tenant. And it's, I mean, what is the problem? I mean, some of these houses I've go in to do the interviews are just like really in bad, bad shape. I'm like, why do you want to stay here? Why? But, you know, and to them, it's like sometimes it's very cost effective for them to stay in the place, because right. They don't, like Sharon said, they don't have the money to move. And then again, it's like, well, I'm stuck in a sense, because no one, a lot of times they don't get their security deposit back.
Right.
So that's also an issue too. So
makes it really hard to move.
Exactly.
Sharon's problem of lack of other affordable housing options.
Exactly.
So it becomes a little bit of a cycle. Yeah. Now, Samantha, I know the city held a series of hearings to sort of see what was up before the initiatives. What kind of stuff came up at those hearings? What did you hear from whether it was individuals or groups?
Yeah, so a couple of things that both Sharon and Palmer have mentioned already. Housing stock here in the city is incredibly old. It's in a lot of disrepair. It's expensive to repair. There are some landlords who are just not willing to put that level of investment in. And at the same time, it's not affordable compared to the incomes that many of our residents in the city have. And so a lot of people look at Syracuse's housing market and say, oh, it actually seems very affordable comparatively to other parts of the country and even the state. But we have such a high poverty rate here in the city, and people who are just working day in, day out to make ends meet, that it's not affordable for a huge swath of our population. Along that line, a big thing that came out of different interviews and research that we had done that was kind of not on our radar yet was the issue of security deposits. When people are forced to move, whether it's because of it unsafe, unhealthy housing, or because of an eviction, they had an emergency come up, and so suddenly they can't make that month's rent. They don't have those funds to get moved directly into the next place when you have somewhere between $800 to $1,000 or more dollars in a security deposit, when you're definitely not getting that back within, like, immediately. There's a three-week span that landlords have to return it. But might not be getting it back at all. And so you're either couch surfing for a month or two while you're trying to figure that out, going in and out of homeless shelters. There's just a whole lot of things in play that are compiling against people trying to find a place to live.
And as you guys have mentioned, I mean, it seems like there's a number of things that go into finding stable, affordable housing. Is there anything that is specific or unique to Syracuse that really complicates this issue, that it's something that we're tackling here in Central New York?
To be honest, I don't think anything's unique, because it's a nationwide problem. It's a housing crisis, like, literally everywhere. I've been studying things across the nation, New York City and California and San Francisco. Those are the top markets that have, like, a lot of homeless people on the rise. And Syracuse is no different. It's just we're tackling it in a different way and immediately when it starts, versus, like, waiting 10, 20 years and then say we have a really huge problem here. We're lucky in the fact that we have a mayor who's focused on housing really right at the precipice, you know, when it's first starting to really hit us hard, you know?
I would add that Syracuse has a very, very high poverty level. One of the highest in the United States. In addition, we have a history of segregation, and the people of color are in these areas where the worst housing conditions exist. So I think in many ways we have a very deep problem to try to deal with, because we're working on so many different levels to help people move out of poverty, but it's also move out of those neighborhoods into other neighborhoods.
We've been discussing housing stability, which is really you go to your home and you're not sure you're going to be there next month or next year. Those of us who have had stable housing and had the benefit, you know, economically and situationally to not face that, for those families, especially with children, how does it affect a family? I mean, one might say, well, you live in a place for a year and you have to move to another place. As we've discussed, it's not that simple. But what are the other effects other than just you don't know where you might be living in a year from now, and then that has impacts on health, education, you know, family dynamics, relationships, et cetera?
Yeah, I would say it's a huge, broad impact on a family having to move what is more than likely more than once a year. Our American Community Survey data only tracks a year-to-year basis, but we know families are moving far more frequently than that. And the fact is that, like, if you're having to move, I mean, even when I move, moving in and of itself is expensive, so it creates additional economic stress. Mm-hmm. But it has a whole lot of emotional and just livelihood impacts as well. If you're frequently moving, you might be missing days of work. People lose jobs because they're having to move so frequently, which then adds to a cycle of further instability to pay your bills. And it has a lot of impact on kids. If you're moving schools, not making school certain days, not sure where your next meal is necessarily coming from, couch surfing with friends, they're not focusing on school. You know, they're focusing on that they're hungry or that they're not sure where they're going to sleep that night. And so it has a drastic impact on students' ability to continue to achieve in their classes and moving forward in their eventual adult lives as well.
Yeah, we actually uncovered some of that in our City Limits Poverty Project, that notion of being, say, coming to third grade but not really being ready for learning at the third grade level then means you're not ready to go to middle school, which now you're already behind to get to high school, and the high school graduation rate is probably the educational factor that gets the most attention, but also that probably predicts economic success after high school. So that problem of not coming out of high school ready to thrive might have started in third grade with housing instability. So.
And we think oftentimes it does. That's why there's such a focus in on that kind of third grade reading level. Mm-hmm. It's where you switch from reading or learning to read over to reading to learn. And if you're, you know, already behind at that point, then you're going to be set back moving forward.
And we've talked a little bit about education, which is seems to housing stability plays a big role in how kids learn. What are some of the other areas that housing extends into beyond education or economic success? I mean, is it a public health concern? Is it something of an environmental issue? Any of those areas, do they all overlap?
I would say yes, because in Syracuse, we also have a huge lead problem. And because the housing is old, and one of the things that TNT Southside Housing Task Force does is try to educate tenants. We have tenant teach-ins, you know, we're throwing a block party this summer to educate tenants on lead poisoning, because it's such a huge problem. When I do get people in to speak in our teach-ins, it's like they're telling me about other problems in their homes, like a leaky pipe, moisture buildup. I have all these allergies in my nose, respiratory conditions, lots of respiratory conditions. And it's and since we know Syracuse have over 60% renters, it's like we're missing like a whole bunch of people because they're too afraid to call codes a lot of the times, so, because they don't want to be kicked out, because, again, the financial aspect is a huge problem.
And the health issues, again, would you say, and again, Sharon, you've worked with tenants for a long, long time, are there even mental health comparisons with trauma of just, you know, again, not having the stability that we might enjoy being able to have some control over our housing situation?
I think there's a large number of people who are having housing instability who start off with mental health issues, and it's just not an environment where they can deal with the health. So State of New York has health home case managers for people, which are focused on getting them to follow through with doctors and take their prescriptions and getting their transportation. But all those agencies, whether it be SearCare, St. Joseph's, they are dealing with housing, these case managers, because you can't even start to deal with keeping your health if you don't know where you're going to live.
Right.
And you know, and when some of these housing conditions like bed bugs, for instance, the effect on a person who has mental health issues is just magnified, their inability to deal with it, and the effect of setbacks in their treatment and stability. So it's all connected.
Gotcha. Can I just kind of touch on something, because it sure. Since I interview people in their homes, I've interviewed people who like bawling, crying, and then when I ask them, one of the last questions is like, where are you gonna go after this? What's the next step? And it's like, I don't know. It's just so stressing. These are people, kids. I'm like, okay, well, what do you feel would be best for you going forward? Do you have any type of person that will help you? You're getting assistance. You're going to this program or this agency, and they, you know, they still facepalm, even though they shake their head yes, and you can see the reality, the look on their face, like they're just in that moment, they're in this this despair bubble, and it's ridiculous, right. And it's utterly ridiculous sometimes. Now, sometimes it really is out of their own control to do something about mm-hmm. it, but mm-hmm. they feel in that moment it's out of their control, you know?
Right. So we've talked about evictions, poverty, landlord issues, code issues, et cetera, health and education impacts. Syracuse Mayor Ben Walsh has had a set of initiatives announced just earlier this spring to do something about it. Coming up, we'll get into a little more detail about those initiatives to improve housing stability. What kinds of efforts are on tap to reduce evictions, improve Syracuse's housing quality, and get more resources into the hands of families that need help to have a safe, healthy, and stable home? This is 88.3 WAER.
Digital content on WAER is supported by SRC Incorporated, a not-for-profit research and development company whose goal is to bring a focus of respect, teamwork, and the freedom to innovate to the workplace. Learn more at srcinc.com/WAER. Welcome back to Syracuse Speaks. We're discussing how people in Syracuse can have a better chance at secure, affordable housing. Coming up a little later, we'll examine just how the city might keep improving issues on the housing front. But first, City Hall has released a program of 11 initiatives to improve housing. We're here with Samantha Lynette from the City of Syracuse's Office of Innovation, Palmer Harvey, who's a community researcher studying eviction with Syracuse University's Maxwell School, and TNT's Southside Housing Tax Force co-chair, and Sharon Sherman, executive director of the Greater Syracuse Tenants Network. One of the problems we've talked about was the rate of evictions and the number of people who move every year, affecting children, education, and other things. Some of these new initiatives are meant to address that. So, Samantha, we'll start with you. What is the city doing to tackle eviction specifically?
Yeah, so we have three specific initiatives that are targeted at helping to reduce evictions. None of them are totally internal to the city. It's a community-wide problem, and we've gotten a ton of support from local organizations, other government agencies. And so a couple of the things that we're working on, one is our Department of Neighborhood and Business Development developed an eviction prevention program starting with Syracuse Housing Authority and then also working with Clinton Plaza to just do early intervention case management with tenants who are falling behind on their rent in those apartment complexes. And so the way that kind of works is instead you miss a month's rent, instead of immediately giving an eviction notice, they're reaching out, working with caseworkers, either internal to the housing authority or in the case of Clinton Plaza with Catholic Charities, to reach out to those tenants, say, hey, we noticed you're falling behind on your rent. You know, what's going on? Is there anything we can help with? Get you connected to different resources, Department of Social Services, different things like that. And they've had just a miraculous, results in terms of reducing eviction rates in both of those complexes. In addition to the Housing Authority and Management and Clinton Plaza have both saved well over $100,000 in a year of the program from reduced eviction costs, reduced turnovers. And so we, for the most part, just sort of helped advising on that. I've got to give Sue McMahon in our Department of Neighborhood and Business Development, a huge credit. She's run the whole thing working with those different partners. And we're now looking to expand to other housing complexes. Mm-hmm. We're also looking to try and tie, the ability to file an eviction with the court to having a valid rental registration or, working out some way to make sure, if you are looking to evict a tenant, you're legally renting, which without having a rental registration or certificate of compliance technicalities, in the city, you're technically not legally renting. And so that's still very much a preliminary and ongoing discussion that we hope could yield some good results. And then lastly, we're working with a startup company called Veet Labs through a startup and residence program that the city participated in this year, which is looking to try and address more directly that funding issue. And so the idea is And people get evicted because they can't pay their rent, because something happens and they just can't make that month's payment. And so how do we find a way to inject funds from the community to those residents in need to keep them in place, or at least make that move as easy as possible? And so we're going to be piloting a crowdfunding initiative to be able to kind of get donated funds from the community, from people who are in a place where they're able to do that, that would then be filed through to residents in need, working with Catholic Charities to administer that, to just be an additional pot of funding that has less income restrictions than some of the HUD funding that currently exists.
Palmer, how often could it be that just one crisis is the reason for an eviction, and one time where the city or the crowdfunding source or a case manager in a building could step in and solve the crisis of the moment to not lead to the next crisis, which is eviction and all of the concomitant problems?
I think it's very easy to follow. And just from the interviews I've done so thus far, one particular woman, she was married, and she said she would rather pay not pay rent than not feed her kids. It was that simple. Mm-hmm. So that's how she got into trouble. But she said she would pay back rent, or has to make work out some deal with the landlord. And I just think this particular time she couldn't do it because something was broken in the house and the person refused to fix it and the kids were getting sick. So she was like, well, you know, it's better off me moving and make work out some payment plan later on. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just that simple. Most people in America can afford like a $400 emergency. And I've noticed a lot of people, it's even worse here. So it's probably like a $200 emergency. People just don't make enough to save, you know, versus, you know, the amount of rent they pay. Most people are paying over 50% of their own income. And then you have their kids on top of it. It's just like a slow rolling nightmare. If something happens, it's going to be a big problem.
Sure.
Yeah.
I do feel, though, that the approach of the eviction prevention is really important to dealing with a considerable number of people. We have a tenants association at Clinton Plaza, and we've certainly seen the result, particularly when someone is in subsidized housing. The fact that they lose that housing when the rent is already adjusted to their income shows that just that little bit of help can straighten things out. You'd be surprised that people may not have been applying for food stamps, or they had a problem with food stamps, or they had a problem with something. And, you know, I think it'll be good for the community to stabilize the people in subsidized housing. However, that will mean there'll be less vacancies for people who would like to move into it. I'd also like to say that, you know, it's particularly helpful. There's a population besides the very important people of children. We have a lot of single adults who, due to mental illness, other issues, don't work and are not connected into anything. Mm-hmm. And they really need these kinds of case management.
Which ends up kind of being a one-on-one thing to figure out what their deal is, whether that's hooking them up with food stamps because one barrier got in the way and then they don't have it, and then that impacts their cash flow, or a health situation, as you were talking about earlier.
Right. They're not seeking help. They can't get a phone. There are free phones for every poor person. There's so many issues that get people need help.
Well, I just want to add something to Sharon was saying. I just want to put on the other side. It's just like stigma if you go and get services too that people don't realize as well. You know, we in the media has made it such a big issue. I should say some of our lawmakers too our ideal or how we formulate our society is like, the last thing you want to do is to do this, or you're seen in a certain type of way after that. Mm-hmm. Because one of the problems is people, landlords do discriminate you based on source of income. And that's like a demerit against you going moving forward. Even if you want to move, it's like, well, I don't take this, I don't take that. That's why we have come to this point where the state lawmakers have adopted the source of income law because of that problem. It's such a huge problem still, even though it has been passed. I mean, I've done two hearings thus far, and I had two landlords basically admit that they weren't taking, you know, people before, because based on these criteria. And if you have a lot of kids, that's the mirror against you too. So, I mean, it's just a shameful system that we've created in people's minds and thinking, and we had to change, subvert the whole issue. And then the mental health crisis is a crisis here, because I notice a lot of times in court that people clearly have mental problems that are not being addressed, and they have to come in court alone, and then luckily the lawyers there, they're really good at navigating people like this, but it's obvious that they need somebody there with them to help them out, you know.
And I guess it sounds a lot like what you guys are trying to say is that there's a real need to break down isolation of people who face unstable housing. And something like the Clinton Plaza initiative really does put someone one-on-one, makes it very personal. What are some other ways that you're trying to really get to people so that they don't have to do this alone? Because sometimes it is a confusing process, and it is scary, and it's there's stigmas that they face that make it all the harder.
Well, I'll do an intro. I'm going to pass it off to the both of you because you're the ones who I know are doing a lot of this work. We're a resource-rich community here in Syracuse. We have high levels of poverty. We have a lot of organizations and nonprofits doing really, really good work to try and connect with those residents. There's just oftentimes a gap. There's so much, it's hard to navigate. And so Sharon, both in her work, and Palmer through the Southside TNT have worked to reach out to tenants and work with them to either connect them to resources, educate them on different resources, walk with them and help them sign up for what they need to. And so I'll let you guys talk a little bit more about
it. I'll start first. Our housing task force, we just noticed a lot of people were having issues, especially tenants. So we created the tenant teach-in. We teach tenants their tenants' rights, wrong, and their power. Because when we're hearing stories and people tell us about their situation, we know it's like, well, you did that wrong. Do you know that's not right? You know you have to do this, you know? And then we sit there and listen to the stories. Okay, so we just take it from here's A, B, C, and this is what you do. And this is, you have to keep this, you have to do that. And it's like preparing them for battle a lot of times, because it is. Because if you're at the point of eviction, you better make sure you have your paperwork straight. And people don't understand that. Like, okay, you don't pay it this way. Don't use the money or use a check. Get a bank account. Most people don't have bank accounts. That's really shocking, you know, learning. I'm like, how do you not know this? But then again,
it's a simple thing that then gets in the way of documentation.
Exactly. And you constantly see these landlords or these people who are representing the landlords come with big stacks of papers of everything you've ever done on the tenant, but the tenant has like nothing. Maybe they'll come in with like a few receipts, and maybe there's one good tenant that has like everything they've ever done inside their home. And it's so important that you document every single thing, even what they didn't fix. Take pictures, all these things. And I'm learning on the job, so to speak, about every little minute thing. So I think in general, people don't learn. It's like, this is what it is to go into an apartment, and here's your tenant's rights booklet. This is what you need to do. Save the pictures. Go over there. Film the apartment before you go in. You know, check online, see if there's any code violations. No, I didn't learn that when I first got my first apartment. Literally, everything is on the job. I think that goes for most people. So I'm not surprised this is happening. But to the extent of how bad Syracuse is, everybody should know this. Because I take it to the point, even though it's not part of my job as a community researcher, I noticed that one of the last questions we asked is like, what do you know about tenants' rights? Mm-hmm. And most people said nothing or little at all. So I started carrying tenants' rights booklets with me. It was, this is how bad it is, you know?
Right. Yeah.
So I've been doing this, unfortunately, since like 1994, talking to individual tenants on the phone. And, you know, I have all credit to Palmer because she's really in the throes of it. And hearing people cry on the phone is terrible. But what we have decided to do is we're now doing training for the case managers. Mm-hmm. And that is very important. The training involves all the legal services, the health department, Section 8, and it's a full-day training so that when a tenant sits at their desk and says they're there for medical case management and they say, I'm being evicted, what does that mean? And which legal service agency do they refer them to? Because we are rich in services, but they've divided up so that they don't duplicate? Or, you know, who do they call, you know? So we're giving them a lot of information and hopefully spreading out the message, because that's the best we can do at this point.
Now, one of the areas of the initiatives is resources. And I assume that's resources in terms of the actual resource, but also connection to.
Yeah. So directly at the city, we've done a lot of work to try and help educate people specifically around code enforcement. We run our code enforcement department. We don't want people afraid to call codes. Our job is to help ensure that they're in safe and healthy housing. And so we have done a lot of outreach through our codes department to different areas of the community, through our TOP pilot that will be expanding later this year, but also through events such as like a Healthy Housing 101, which did target more directly those kind of service providers and case managers to say, hey, if you're doing a home visit, these are the kind of things we're looking for that we're really concerned about. We had code inspectors lead tours through a land bank house. We're doing that again this year on June 7th. So feel free to check that out. It's completely free and open to the public. We play music. We have the inspectors there. There's a ton of informational resources set up on tables. We feed you.
Do residents go to that kind of thing and then learn, hey, my leaky this or the basement that looks like that is actually a code violation? And then
get some knowledge? This specific event targets more of service providers because it is in the middle of the day.
Gotcha.
But we definitely had people who were walking by last year who were like, hey, what is this? What's going on? And like neighbors who popped over who, you know, everyone is welcome. We also do a lot of events and education by going to community meetings in evenings, reaching out through community centers and connecting with service providers who are already working directly with those residents. We do everything we can to meet them where they are. We don't want to make it more difficult or out of their way to have to access information. And then we've also been working on, to Palmer's point of, you know, going online, checking out if a property has code violations prior to moving in. We have that online portal through our property system. It's not the like prettiest or easiest to use. And so Sharon actually goes over how to use it in her service provider training. And so we are working on actually with the iSchool here up at SU to develop a website that essentially assigns grades to rental properties where you could just go in and type in the address.
Yes.
It'll show you,
thank you,
the code violations, if there are, like, history, if there are any, whether it's rental registered. And so we're moving into like a third phase of development with that, with a group of iSchool students.
And that's based off of RentLogic from New York City, correct?
Correct, yes.
So that's in that website, you can do, like you said, there's a grade assigned. You can see the property before you rent. What other things have you learned from different cities? I know that the REAP program is also based off of a program in LA.
Yeah, the majority of work that our office does is actually stealing the best ideas from other cities. That's actually part of the Bloomberg grant philosophy of, mm-hmm, you know, research best practices, learn what's working in other places, see how you can make it work here. And so, like you mentioned, the Rent Escrow Account Program, yes, or REAP, is one that we are currently doing some feasibility study on of whether we have the capacity to take that on in City Hall.
Can you explain that a little bit?
Yes. Yeah. It will. The idea behind REAP is that we have the legal right in New York State, or tenants have the legal right in New York State, to withhold their rent if there's a documented code violation on the property. A lot of tenants know that they're able to withhold rent. A lot of them don't know all the crazy specifications to be able to do it legally. And so it has to be documented by the city's code enforcement or county health, you know, some government agency. And you're supposed to hold that money in an escrow account, because if your landlord does come and make the fix, you have to pay back that back rent, or they can legally evict you for non-payment. And so the idea behind REAP is that the city actually helps you to do that process. And so we would notify you, hey, you have a qualifying code violation. It's triggered through us citing through our code enforcement. Mm-hmm. So we already know it's cited. and we would actually hold an escrow account for them. And so instead of paying your rent to your landlord while you're working to trying to withhold rent to get them to make those fixes, you pay it to the city. Mm. It goes directly into your escrow account. And then you have that there when, if the fix does happen and it all works out, that then the landlord can get it from the city. And so we know that it's to help secure against that kind of retaliatory eviction or crazy process quirk that sort of happens. Hmm.
It seems like the other area for the 11 city initiatives is housing quality, which in some ways seems like the most overwhelming nut to crack. What kind of things, maybe sort of in brief now, and we'll maybe get into it a little bit more in a few minutes, what kind of things can be done that really look at housing quality? I mean, code enforcement is maybe the simplest, but it's a bigger issue than that, whether it's a house, old house, as Sharon was talking about, or apartment building that has a landlord that hasn't kept stuff up.
Yeah, no, it's definitely a huge issue. We have incredibly old housing stock. Over 90% of our housing stock was built pre-lead being illegal to use. Mm-hmm. And so a huge portion of it is at risk of having lead paint. Our biggest avenue at the city is through code enforcement. But, I mean, really what we need is for people to invest in their properties, take pride in what they own, and be able to make those updates to properties. And, you know, that's really the only way that you kind of get into fixing them up is by actually fixing them up. And a lot of times in 100-year-old homes, that's incredibly expensive to do.
So the Greater Syracuse Tenants Network, wanting to see more housing, affordable housing, we have a landlord training program. Mm-hmm. And this is was actually started under Mayor Bernardi and was more focused on keeping criminals and drug people out. But it was done at home headquarters, and then we took it over. And according to HUD, 70% of the rental housing in the United States is actually owned by landlords who have, less than 10 properties. Hmm. And I think that's true in our city. Now, it might be changing now after the real estate crisis of 2008, but many of these landlords consider the property owning not their real job.
Hmm, right.
And therefore, they don't have the knowledge or the information. They also may have an attitude that only the rich developers can reach out to the city for help. Hmm. So, we have this training to introduce them to the departments, and code enforcement says, the assistant director, Sam Perry, says, here's my card. Call me before we're at your door. And explaining that it's complaint driven. Mm-hmm. So we're not they're not picking on you. The reality is, if a tenant complains, that's going to start something. Home headquarters has started a program now for loaning to investors. Hmm. For 30 years, they loaned to homeowners. So very often, a small landlord cannot go to a bank. They end up putting repairs on their credit card, which is a terrible way to do it. So that's bringing in resources for the smaller landlord. 25% of the people are people who come to the class and they say, oh, I don't use a computer. Hmm. Well, we're all based on everything's on the computer. So right. We're trying to work through that and getting more resources to them. So, it's the horrible landlords that we're all dealing with every day that get all the news and all the negatives.
Right.
But if we don't get more decent, responsible landlords coming into these neighborhoods, it's not going to be the government who's going to rehab all these houses. We need to get more people in this business who are, legitimately interested.
I'm just thinking, just to add something to what Sharon is saying, is that I think some of these landlords have a sense of entitlement that, I can't afford to fix up the house. If you can't afford to fix up the house, you need to sell it. That's my thing of it is. You don't have to keep it. What makes you different from a Sears or a Target or anything of those things that when businesses go out of business because they can't afford or their sales goes down? You're not entitled to keep somebody in a home that's falling apart to collect money for what wherever you're using it for, because it's not for repairs. So this is the hard thing. And people look at me like I'm crazy when I say this, like, oh, how could I sell my property? Well, you can't afford to do anything with it. And then I constantly get this like pushback, like, well, I'm not a bad landlord. Well, I'm sorry you don't think you're a bad landlord, but when things don't get repaired and things go out the wayside, there's somebody who's living in the mess you literally created, you know? So I want to be, you know, very forthright, and I'm always honest with both the tenant and the landlord. But you're running a business. Your business model sucks, to be honest, because few people would buy a product that was kept breaking all the time and keep spending, putting money into it. So to the same person who built that product, if your product's crappy, why should I give you money for it? That's my issue.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about the city's plans to improve housing stability in Syracuse. And coming up, Syracuse has had a number of programs to improve local housing over the years. But how can the city do more given the compounding factors of poverty and so many poor quality housing options? This is Syracuse Speaks here on 88.3 WAER. WAER is happy to be part of your community, but we realize that a lot of times you're on the go. Or maybe you can't connect with WAER. And that's why we've developed the WAER mobile app, so you can take us with you wherever you go. Stream our broadcast, browse our website, and listen to the latest on-demand audio. Available in the Apple and Google Play Store, just search for WAER.
This is Syracuse Speaks, and we're examining what Syracuse plans to do to improve the housing situation for many people in the city. We're joined by Sharon Sherman from the Greater Syracuse Tenants Network, Samantha Lynette from the Syracuse I-Team, and Palmer Harvey, a researcher on evictions and with the TNT Southside Housing Task Force. Now, we've been talking about some of the efforts and initiatives the city is making into areas such as eviction, resources available to tenants, and maybe improving housing quality. Samantha, one of the things that touches me or occurs to me is just the sheer numbers. Some of the value of these programs is the one-on-one approach, yet there's so many homes, there's so many tenants, et cetera. How far can we get? How much of an impact can we have?
Yeah, I mean, obviously scalability of any program is always a huge challenge. And, you know, we are constantly thinking about how we can expand it and be efficient, reach as much of people, houses as we possibly can. And we know within these 11 initiatives, we're not solving housing stability. We're addressing some of the key challenges that people who struggle with housing stability face. A lot of it is looking at symptoms and not necessarily really drilling into that income housing cost problem. And so on a grander scale, it has to be a very collaborative effort between not just the city, but in community organizations, our county, our state. You know, it's been really, really exciting to see all of this collaboration that's been happening. And it seems like, you know, it's all coalescing together. There's been a lot of exciting movement, I think, since Mayor Walsh started, and kind of all of these groups, are even pre him, had been getting together and moving in this direction. And so, you know, we push as far as we can, but obviously we all need help.
And we were just talking a moment ago about how the city can't do it alone. So let's go there. Palmer, you were just at a tenants speak out in Albany. What kind of things are what role does the city need to play, but what help does it need from the state or federal government or outside agencies?
Number one, tougher laws. You know, I mean, even though they have laws in the books, they're just not working adequately enough. and especially to be fair to the tenants themselves, because most things are just, or not just to the tenants, just throughout New York State, because most of the caveats are, that have tough, they have tough rental regulation laws already on the books, but it's mostly for New York City.
Right.
And to the rest of the state, that's not fair. You know, like, okay, why are they able to do all these things here, but not there? And then, well, a lot of times what happens, we have a lot of outside people who own property here who are from New York City because they know the laws are less, not as stricter, will come here and decimate neighborhoods because they know that, you know, the local, they throw them a few thousand dollars for their local election and that's it. That, you know, a few thousand dollars could sell us all out, to be honest. You know, just from speaking at before the Common Council and the Common Council person, LaToya, I forgot her last name, but
Alan,
spoke out about this. We're on the ground. We actually see what happens. What's the after effect if you don't act now? Because clearly these people who are the bad actors have literally, they run your city. I'm just going to say it. They just run your city. You have no power at this point. You have the power to change it, but you're not actively doing anything about it. You think you are, but you're not.
The two things that have been talked about recently are the good cause eviction bill and the
rental regulations
that are in New York City to expand to the rest of the state. Are those the kinds of things you're talking about, or don't they go far enough?
Yeah, well,
either?
Actually, only two is going to actually affect Syracuse in itself. But, you know, good cause eviction, it's like the encompass of all those bills because it makes good sense to start there because retaliatory eviction is a thing. You don't want people just to kick you out for anything. You know, you have to have something to say, okay, what did I do? Because I didn't break my lease. You know, you can still evict people because they broke their lease in some place. But it's like so many things that they can say, I don't want you being here because maybe you were loud one day. And it could be anything. And it is anything. Because just from my experience going to court, it just hearing some of the stories, it's just not because they haven't paid rent. It's just like, well, I don't like this person because they spoke to me in a certain way, you know? They may be, that tenant may be upset in that moment. It's not how they usually are, but it's just ridiculous amount of stories that I'm hearing and that something needs to happen.
That lead to eviction.
Yeah.
These things that you wouldn't otherwise think.
Exactly.
I did want to clarify. So in Syracuse, most lower income tenants are what we call month-to-month tenants. And the beauty from the tenant's point of view is, well, I only have to give a month's notice if I want to leave. However, it's gotten to the point now that it's the easy way. This is short of going to court. They give a legal 30 days notice and the tenant is out. So we had the first retaliatory eviction law in New York State in Syracuse. Our law was used to write the state law. But the reality is the law says you cannot retaliate against somebody for reporting to code enforcement. But without just cause for eviction, the landlord could say, I just do not want to renew your lease for the next after 30 days. This is where we need this law so that tenants, if a landlord wants to evict you for nonpayment, fine. Big issue in Syracuse now, if they have a no smoking policy and you continually smoke, they can go to court and evict you. They will be able to. But in terms of you reported to codes, they cannot terminate your lease.
Right, that retaliatory.
And it could be taken to court and there can be penalties for evicting with the documentation that they reported to codes. So that's going to be wonderful.
Are there other state or federal either resources that need to be better or policies that would help in the situation that we're in here in Syracuse?
Well, the federal government is trying to get rid of public housing, and that is essential. We've had, you know, really good public housing. Now it's a little more troubled. And as we look at, we never can get away from the I-81 situation.
Right.
We need to make sure that all the public housing units are replaced one for one. So for any demolition, we need one for one because we've lost over 1,000 units of subsidized housing over the past 15 years. So, and it's federal government.
So like you mentioned, I-81 is on the horizon, I mean, with the DEIS out. And there's a number of other things that are coming at Syracuse probably within the next year. The census is happening, and housing stability and count, getting an accurate count in the census is a huge hurdle to jump. So how are you guys planning, I mean, all three of you who are working in this sphere, working to make sure that housing stability remains a priority in those major projects, and also making sure that those major projects go in a way that is productive for Syracuse?
So I don't, it's not going to be a surprise to anyone that, you know, the mayor and the administration is highly supportive of the community grid. We were very happy that the statement came out with that being the suggested option to go with. That's, even if that is the final decision, there, it's a long haul to make sure that everything beyond that is done correctly. Housing stability, working with our housing authority to, again, make, they're going to be impacted no matter what the resolution is. Make sure that we have the number of public housing units that we're going to be losing, you know, that, like Sharon said, it needs to be one-to-one. Making sure that land that opens up is developed equitably, in, you know, that in a way that benefits all people in the community and not just, you know, university area or downtown or some of the other more economically thriving spots. And also, it's a big opportunity for local hiring, I-81 would be. And when funding and jobs are such a huge challenge for people in maintaining their housing stability, being able to get residents hired for a major construction project like that, trained and hired through different programs, could be a huge benefit for helping with their own economic stability overall.
And on the census, I know the mayor's involved, but there's been gatherings of community groups. There's going to be a tremendous effort in Syracuse to get that count, because that will affect, among other things, our funding from CDBG is based on our population. So
that's community development block grant funding, which goes to neighborhood
housing
programs and programs.
Housing. Yeah. So the census is going to be something that there's already been meetings in Syracuse.
Right.
It's crucial.
Mm-hmm. I want to return back to something that you said, Samantha, about developing equitably. If this housing stability does go through, how does the city make sure that those who have historically been in these communities that have horrible housing stability don't get pushed out of their same communities?
That is a really amazing question. I think gentrification is a challenge that's being seen across the country. And to be quite honest with you, I have not seen a city that's dealing with it well. I think rent protections and other types of tenant housing protections certainly go a long way to assisting in that. It comes with some really incredibly intentional development. I have, you know, heard people in the community say, once we get to gentrification, that's like a good problem to have. Like, we have such high poverty rates here, like we're nowhere close. And I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that, you know, it's coming, particularly with a lot of these larger projects that are coming to the community, and we need to be prepared to look forward and see how we keep people who are housed in stable and quality housing so that they're not priced out by rents going up with further development. And I think it will require just a lot of groups, both from the city internally and the Common Council, but also, you know, community groups putting lots of pressure on us to make sure that those policies are being done well, and hopefully some legislation down from the state on rent control and things like that can be useful as well.
I just want to add, which we didn't exactly talk about earlier, part of improving the housing is increasing the number of families that are not low income living in the city.
Mm-hmm.
So we touched on education as it affects individual families, but it's very important that our education system is improved, because we need the diversity, and it'll help the market if there's more people moving and staying in the city that you know, even that are renting, but are in those lower income jobs or moderate income jobs and are continuing to stay in the city. So our school system is an important part of the whole housing picture.
I want to finish up with just this question that, you know, you all can answer to the extent that you'd like. The city's done other things in the past to address housing quality, the availability of affordable housing, what neighborhoods look like. You know, I can remember the Syracuse Neighborhood Initiative was millions of federal dollars targeted to this neighborhood or that neighborhood. They had short-term effects. Some of those effects may still be lasting. Some I know are not. We have the land bank now, which really is going after housing quality, especially the zombie home or the really poor housing stock, to do something with it, which could include demolition or finding somebody to renovate those homes. How are we now going to make these changes have more life, have more impact, given that there have been efforts to do this stuff in the past? Samantha, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I think one of the things that we try and focus in on, at least in our office's work, and I know our neighborhood and business development does a lot as well, is looking at not just programs, but systems types of issues. And so, you know, a lot of these challenges come from systemic historical policy and practice. You know, Sharon made reference to redlining earlier. They're big things to tackle. And so we need to be doing them in a way that doesn't just look at a short-term quick win, but that also includes policies and procedures that look long-term. And so in our portfolio of the 11 initiatives that we released, we have, you know, a variation of those different things. Some of them are like quick wins. What can we get off quickly that will have some short-term impact so that we can be helping people right now? But a lot of them are larger program projects that are take us a really long time and a lot of effort to get up and going, but you know, it's worth it because it's going to have that longer term policy impact.
Sharon, what would you say about some of the past efforts given, you know, in context of where we are now?
I feel like we just have to keep trying. It is true that we've gone through some very hard economic times in Syracuse, and that has made, I think, the housing instability is definitely worse than it was. But I think there's new things to try and new initiatives. And, you know, we just have to keep positive about it because what else would we do?
Right, gotcha.
So, yeah, I remember all those programs you mentioned. And I would say that in the past, there was so much emphasis on getting homeowners and benefits. I used to go to the meetings once a year, the community development block ran and say, I'm the only one talking about tenants. And even then, 68% of the population are tenants in Syracuse. So there is a change in emphasis. There is a recognition that homeownership is not the answer.
Well, I think we need just to diversify on what we're doing. It's like, even though we have a lot of programs and we're doing a lot to help people, but also we need to find ways that people help themselves and change the game in the sense of, like, for instance, like collective housing. We've done teaches on this in the past, the Housing Task Force, and we're talking about people, maybe condos are changing. We have so many two to four families here. We can break those things up and have people afford to own their own apartment on their own at a lower rate. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be what we have now. We're at the precipice. We could change the game, so to speak, and start afresh. And I think that's something we need to focus on more than what we were doing that has not been working today.
All right. Well, I want to thank you all for joining us for Syracuse Speaks. We've been discussing how Syracuse can improve housing stability for the many people and families in the city that struggle with simply having a safe, secure, and reliable place to live.
And we want to thank Samantha Lynette from the city's Office of Innovation, Palmer Harvey, who serves as a co-chair on TNT's Southside Housing Task Force and is a community researcher studying eviction with Syracuse University's Maxwell School, and Sharon Sherman, who is the executive director of the Greater Syracuse Tenants Network. Thank you for listening. I'm Katie Zolkowski.
And I'm Chris Bolt. This is 88.3 WAER Syracuse.